So welcome to the East Meets West Spotlight series. We are now on podcast number 10. And the title of this podcast is Introducing the World Bank and Their Role in Advancing LGBTIQ Economic Empowerment. A big thing, but I'm sure we will have a very interesting time to look at it and to listen to our special guest. For those who do not really know the podcast series from East Meets West, why do we do this? East Meets West does this because we often meet people, organizations, actions, where we say, you know, they need a little bit of space to get to know, because otherwise these nice actions would be lost. So therefore we want to give the space to these interesting and innovative members of our community. And for today's podcast number 10, we are very happy and proud to have to welcome Phil Crane. Phil Crane, we know Phil from his time at NGLCC, the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce, where he covered, I think, the large global division. But since then, he moved forward. He has been very active in international organizations with often a link to the main topic. The main topic is social inclusion, economic development, but also a focus on the LGBTIQ community. And this, I think, this work brought Phil also to the strategic role of the World Bank is playing to improving the LGBTIQ well-being. A role that we see is not known enough. Now, World Bank, we all know it, but I think it's still something we need all the information about. But I will stop now talking about it. I give now the stage to Phil to please go ahead and show and tell us more about the World Bank and LGBTIQ well-being.
Yeah, thank you, Ludo. Thank you, Pavel. Really excited to be here to talk about the World Bank Group, which is to say a massive, huge institution that exists in number of countries throughout the world, and really to talk about how it can apply to LGBTI social and economic inclusion. I'll first start with just a quick recap of what the World Bank is, and then we can move into why that matters for LGBTI people and business owners. So it is a institution that was started in 1948 after World War II, following really the devastation that happened throughout Europe. But since then, it has moved well past reconstruction throughout the European region to really take on poverty alleviation throughout the world, and as such is the premier economic development institution, not only in terms of its budget, but also in terms of its intellectual capital, its leverage with governments. It does a lot in this space and is an important player when it comes to, again, poverty alleviation and economic development. There's five parts of the World Bank Group, but really for now, we just focus on the World Bank itself and really look at how this institution can be better understood by LGBTI organizations, business owners, and people in terms of better representing the issues that we work on, that we face, and really leveraging this institution to do much more to combat homophobia and transphobia. A little bit on that particular point, this is a very new agenda for the World Bank. It started maybe 5 to 10 years ago. And it really comes out of the fact that as an institution, it's doing a lot more to address the social and economic drivers of poverty, which has a lot to do with identity, why people are excluded, whether it's an issue of their identity or their gender. This is a newer issue for the bank to be really in the social and identity space. From that, there have been some people starting a handful of years ago, really trying to get this institution to address what are the economic implications when people experience homophobia, transphobia. This is an agenda that, as it started out, was something that the institution didn't really want to address. There was, it's a very complex issue, but again, really through the hard work of many people like Fabrice Houdard, Dr. Lee Badgett, we really pushed internally, and I say we because I was there for 5 years trying to get the bank to really address these issues. And that our push was quite successful. Now it is one of their internal policies, particularly at the level of the headquarters, that a lot of their data and analytics, their programs, and their ways of mitigating risk of exclusion also has to address looking at LGBTI inclusion So this is a really important moment for us as a community and as a movement to see how we can push this international organization, this really large and powerful and influential organization, to do much more on behalf of the issues that we work on.
Perfect. I think you say now also it is like a world, of course, an organization that covers the whole world, I think. What we see for some international organizations that, for instance, when some countries that have a real anti-LGBTI attitude, they, how shall I put it in a nice way, they are not really supportive for any activities for LGBTIQ community. We've seen that, for instance, I think there are other organizations that they, for instance, they will support actions for anti-discrimination by women, of women, that's clear, but LGBTQ not. So is this an issue within the organization, or is this something that has been, let's say, arranged and talked about?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when we were pushing this agenda early on, we started to get the support of senior management, which included the presidents, but also some executive directors, predominantly through Northern Europe. And what emerged from that internal support was to say that, yes, let's really take on the LGBTI agenda through the lens of social inclusion and also gender, right? So at the time, the World Bank's gender director did not want to really sufficiently address these issues. So it was kind of kicked to another part of the institution. So that's where the institutional pathway of social inclusion really took on the bulk of this work, which is to say that that's important in two ways. During this time, the World Bank looked at its safeguard policies. So when it lends to governments, to its clients, hundreds of millions of dollars, they have to ensure that such large amounts of funding don't hurt people or the environment. And what happened through this process was that the new safeguards document, it's called the Environmental and Social Framework, said, all right, let's include LGBTI people into these risk assessments and to mitigate the risk of their exclusion, right? So social inclusion through the lens of those safeguards, through the hook of those safeguards, is ensured that LGBTI people must be part of that, which then goes to its clients. So its clients technically cannot be using these funds to exclude LGBTI people in the programming, which is really important. But again, the question is that being implemented is something that we really have to examine. Mm-hmm. The gender side, by comparison, and again, to reiterate, has not looked at these issues. So, and then that again comes down to the choices of the management within the gender unit. But if that were to become an institutional pathway, that would be very powerful. When the World Bank goes to its clients, to its governments, and has these conversations, it would say, not only can you not exclude, you know, cisgender women, but LGBTI people must be part of this agenda. Mm-hmm. And through all of this, this is better development. This is better economic development. When you work with a client and say you cannot exclude, that's not only an issue that speaks to fundamental human rights, that's also something that speaks to better economic development and anti-poverty outcomes, which is a really important argument to make.
Great. No, this is clear. I have you said about there is this support. The support, they have now this attention for LGBTIQ community. That attention, is it, let's focusing on money? Is it focusing on support? Is it focusing on some reports that you get, some statistical support? What in fact is the support, generally speaking, that the World Bank can give to our, let's say, our region where we work, CE region, with the people that are working there for the community? What is it, to be very concrete, what can it be? Is it grants, whatever? Mm. How do you see that?
Yeah, good question. So it can be a lot, right? So when you look at the World Bank in terms of gender or persons with disabilities or any of the other social issues they work on, there is a lot to draw from by comparison. That is a way of us to see the sheer positive value that this institution could have when we apply to LGBTI people. The trick is that this agenda is very new and the institution we see is not doing enough. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We see that these policies exist quite effectively at the level of the headquarters in Washington, D.C. But again, this is a global institution. So there is this interplay, this institutional interplay between what happens at headquarters and literally the hundreds of country offices that it exists. And in these country offices where most of the important work happens, we do not see these country offices engaging the LGBTI community or talking about these issues to their clients, the governments. So there is so much more that can be done, right? Thus far, we do see that what the support can look like is data and analytics. And this is really important because as an LGBTI community, we need to have much more quantitative data to represent our realities, our challenges, and our contributions. But we don't have that. The World Bank sits there as a very viable mechanism of doing this. From starting in 2001, it really took on its self-declared role as a knowledge bank, right? So not only is it something that lends, but it is also something that gathers data and gives the best recommendations. It is part of its power and branding. So when it comes to data and analytics, they could be doing so much more when it comes to working with LGBTI people to lead this important research. In the European region, they have worked with ERA, so the Equal Rights Association of the Western Balkans and Turkey, to do a really good piece of research in a number of countries in Southeastern Europe. But it can be doing so much more. And here we can look at Eastern Europe, for example, where there is this rise in stigma and discrimination by state actors. The World Bank could be doing a lot of research with the community. The question is, how do we push them to do so? I hope this guide is one way of showing that as a public institution, we have every right to be working with them to do so. So that's the first, data and analytics. Another is programs. So programs is, of course, one of the largest things that they do. When they lend, hundreds of millions of dollars to governments, to their clients, the governments then are supposed to create these programs that incorporate economic development goals, anti-poverty initiatives. And what that means, what that could mean for LGBTI people is that they create specific standalone projects that work with the community, that give them job skills training, that give them ways to build and grow their business. We don't see that yet, but this could be something. And this would increase the scope of resources for our community significantly if the World Bank, through its country offices, were to make these programs. They're not quite yet. And then I would say a third way is another viable point is procurement. Of course, as a global institution with a lot of business needs, procurement is a large part of what they do. So working with a number of organizations in country offices in DC to bring in needed goods and services. And what they do already is work with WeConnect International to ensure that some of those businesses are women-owned. And I would say the next step could be to ensure that some are LGBTI owned. But they're not there yet, but hopefully one day. And again, that will take a lot of work on our side to push for that.
Phil, I think this is what you mentioned, that last thing, the impact that the World Bank has on national governments, because that's the whole thing. There's money given to governments, and when money is in playing there, normally then the World Bank has also some power, some strength to influence decisions. We see that in our, and especially the CE region, in some countries, we know which are the Poland, there are Hungary now, other countries also, we see that there is an active governmental policy against the community, not only ignoring them or not supporting them, against the community. Now, the local people there, our NGOs, the people that are actively working against this, they are very often, they fight and they do things. But I think if I understand you well, what the World Bank could be is a real power of empowerment of these people, that you say, look, jointly with the World Bank, that the World Bank, when they, I simplify it now too much, but if there is money going, that they say, okay, what is happening on that and that and that field? That this way you can really support the situation, the local NGOs, but especially the situation, the status of LGBTIQ people, which in these countries is really dramatical. Yeah, I mean, it's really, it makes me furious when I see what is happening in Poland with these LGBT free zones. This is just disgusting what is happening now in Hungary, where, I mean, this is something where we don't have much power, but there I think the World Bank could really put its weight on actions and also influential governments. I mean, know that in these kind of, let's say, countries with that kind of governments, money is important. We see it from the EU. When the EU stops giving money, they might turn a little bit because they have very big principles. When the money is there, the principles change. We see that. So that might be, and this is something new, I suppose. This is something that has to be developed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the most important points that I'd like to express through this is that as a community, we have every right to engage the World Bank, whether it's in headquarters or in the country offices. We have every right to be there and say, this is what we can be doing, and this is why you should be addressing LGBTI issues, not as an act of charity, but because it's your own policy. And once we really get that into the minds of LGBTI organizations, people and businesses, we can structure that pathway whereby if there is a bill that might be coming law that targets the LGBTI community, the World Bank can be there because it had those consultations, because it is informed, and it can be there to say, this is the economic development impact, and this is not why we support this. And it has such a role to work with governments to ensure that these laws don't keep happening, right? Yeah. And in the guide itself, you know, there are two case studies of where the bank has done this before. The first one is an unfortunate case study. It's not a great one, but it shows us many years back, you know, Uganda was passing this anti-homosexuality bill into law. And I go into this in the guide, but essentially the World Bank was thrust into the limelight, into this dialogue, and they didn't consult civil society. They just said to the government, we can't have this. We'll actually stop a $90 million loan to public health institutions if you pass this, which was kind of a mess because it emboldened the president to say, oh, this is aid conditionality, right? So that's a case study to show us where the World Bank, without having consultations, used its leverage, flexed its muscles, and then that empowered and emboldened the president to say, oh, aid conditionality, which we don't want, you're forcing this on us. Yeah. That cleared itself up through a few different details that I would welcome, you know, the readers to look at it in the guide. But if we juxtapose that to Tanzania a few years later, the difference then is that the World Bank had its sexual orientation and gender identity global advisor. So he came in and said, this is something viable we can do, but let's do it much more intelligently. So he, in Tanzania, when a similar bill was becoming law, they had consultations with the community. They worked with the country office, and they had much more holistic and intelligent conversations that actually allowed dialogue with the government. Yeah. So they did not pass this law. And I think it's such a good example when you pair consultations and doing one's homework with effective dialogue. Mm. We could be doing this so much more. It's just a matter of civil society to step up and say, we are stakeholders. We must work on this agenda. I see Eastern Europe right now as being a perfect way of having conversations with the World Bank, with its country offices, to say, how can we intelligently work together to stop the government from passing more discriminatory laws?
Yeah. But I think this is a very, very nice way to think about it, to go further in, to investigate how we can do this in a more really efficient and practical way. But I'm sure that the people that live in these countries, and especially the NGOs and activists there, will be very happy to hear it, because this gives them, as I say, an empowered role. They don't want to be too political, because this is something that you cannot really use in these countries. But this way you do the same as the objective, but you use then the World Bank as your support, as a kind of a push to get influence on the level of decision in a country. I think this is very valuable. We have to work on this, certainly. And I think that East meets West as group, I think we might also help there. So there could be a kind of an intermediary to see how we can steer, support, show the way. I think this is something that I would certainly personally also take away from our talk now. And another element is that we know also a little bit from experience, also East meets West. You said you're very active in the headquarters. Now the headquarters is, I'm sure, a huge building, with an enormous number of people in a great city far away. And if you write them a mail that we are an NGO and I don't know this country and we heard about this, I don't think you get much reaction. So for us, my question is now, if we have now people that listen to us from organizations and they say, look, we want to see how we can work on this, what is now the preferred entrance? Because I don't think that the World Bank has in every country somewhere an office. So what would be now a practical, easy way to have a first go at the World Bank, talk, start talking? What would you suggest in this case?
Yeah, I mean, I would shamelessly say the guide helps a lot with this to provide entry points. Then I would remind readers to look at how at a country, regional, and international level, there are these specific entry points that can be created. Mm-hmm. Past that, I would say, yes, through this writing this guide and through working at the bank, I got tons of feedback from around the world that LGBTI yep. organizations send emails to their country office or whoever and just don't get a response. And that's not right. This is a public institution. We have every right to be there. Our government.
This is something that you see with every huge organization. You know, in America, you can write, "Dear Mr. President," and he answers. Well, for PR, he will do that. But writing to huge organizations, the EU is the same thing. Full of people with good intentions, but write a letter, try to contact them. It's hysterical. You can hardly do that. Right. So this is something where we have to find the right way to do it.
Yeah, and just remembering that. You have every right to have a conversation with them, right? We are stakeholders, and by their own policy of stakeholder engagement, they can't ignore us. And this is by virtue of being an organization, and it's also by being virtue of an LGBTI organization, they can't ignore us anymore. There are good examples of country offices engaging the LGBTI community, and the question is how do we push for that in other countries? So I always recommend, you know, finding the right person in the country office, which is their social development specialist, is their gender specialist, is the person who oversees specific programs to health, to labor, et cetera. It's just finding them and making sure that you're clear to them that you know you're everything that you're owed by this institution and that they can't ignore. If they still do, you can find a regional hub in Europe that's in Vienna. There's a really big country office there that works regionally. Yeah. Another way is by engaging the sexual orientation and gender identity, the SOGI global advisor who sits in headquarters, making sure, and his name is Clifton Cortez, doing really great work, making sure that he's aware of the lack of dialogue. Coming up very soon in the next few weeks are the annual meetings, which there's annual meetings and then the spring meetings. It happens twice a year, and it's a way for civil society to officially discuss with senior management and other parts of the institution a number of issues, and that's another way to attend. They are mostly online due to COVID. But outside of that, there's also ways to officially go to DC, if possible, to make sure. There's a number of organizations that are specifically working on the LGBTI agenda from an external standpoint who can help liaise with you. That includes the Council for Global Equality, Human Rights Watch, Human Rights Campaign, the Bank Information Center. There's a number of organizations. If someone wanted to reach out to me, I could connect. Yeah. But again, it's a matter of reaching out to the country office, the regional hub, and then to the right people in its headquarters to make sure that those voices are heard. When it comes to the entry points, there's a number of thematic entry points that one can use, but I won't bore everyone with how many there are.
I think you mentioned also there is this guideline, this material that can be useful for our listeners here. I think that as it is a recorded podcast, I think when we publish it, we can add some links where they can find the information. I think we can also, I don't want to fill your mailbox with a lot of mail. So we will do it probably over East Meets West, if it's okay, to contact you, because this way you will be chased by everybody. But we will take care of that. And I think also for us, I think there is a very interesting role that we did not develop yet for East Meets West. On the one hand, you have this element of business, which is important for, I think, what we do here, that we also try to develop quite successfully, but still growing in our region. we can also be the ones that try to help to let's say to motivate the people to do something. We can talk about it. We can perhaps also mention this once again and invite you once again once in our annual conference, where this can be a very interesting tool. They have a lot of people listening. So I think also for us, I will discuss this with Pavel to see how we can play our role there. But I think this is very promising, especially for the countries in Central Eastern Europe that have now this, as you said, this big issue with discrimination. We are starting an action in Hungary, for instance. We do these things, but there is this element of we are so powerless. But this can be indeed empowering actions for our community there. And really there, I think the World Bank, because the World Bank supports this, helps there, has a link there, they are really then, let's say, touching the people in the field, which I think is also what they want to do. There are a lot of things they do, but then you really touch the essence of the problem. I think it's very, very promising and very interesting. If you want to, please do.
Yeah. I mean, just again to say how important it is that this institution and the other multilateral development banks could be having in this space. It could be such a game changer if civil society effectively leverages them to do much more. The World Bank is leading compared to the other multilateral development banks, but that's still this much compared to we could be doing so much, much more. And it's important because, you know, so often we have discussed LGBTI issues through the lens of human rights, and that it'll always be a human rights agenda forever. But at the same time, what really gets the attention of some governments is when you put an economic cost to it. So you can say that exclusion is detrimental on a socioeconomic and poverty level, and that aggregates to lost GDP, right? And that's something that we did in India, and we've been replicating, you know, when I was at the bank, and then we've been replicating a number of times, and it's very important for the bank to do that. Once it is effectively leveraged and harnessed by civil society as the public institution that it is, another thing that could really emerge from this is just increasing the scope of resources infinitely. I mean, the Global Philanthropy Project looks at how little international funds go to LGBTI issues. It's just tiny bits, it's pennies on hundreds of dollars by comparison. It's just so little going to this. Once we really get the World Bank and other multilateral development banks onto this, it could increase the scope of those resources significantly. I mean, this is an institution that has billions upon billions of dollars for its own annual budget and lends out dozens of billions of dollars to numbers of governments. If we were to just figure out how to leverage part of that for LGBTI people in an equitable way, again, the resources would change the game.
Perfect. So I think that with what we handled here, what we talked about here now is, I think, quite an eye-opener for many of our listeners, because also for me, and we are quite active in everything that happens for LGBT, this is for us also something new, something that we underestimated probably. And if we have this kind of thought, it would be really great to develop it. I think also for East Meets West, and I know Pavel, my friend and colleague in East Meets West, he will also support this. See how we can be there, the driver a little bit, so in the beginning, a driver, and help our people to do this. So I think this is something that we certainly will work on. But please, if we start working on it, don't start complaining the next time there is too much happening, because now you say we don't have enough. I mean, once East Meets West starts pushing, you might be overwhelmed by the request. But I mean, that's something else that will be great. For the rest, I would just like to add to the people that are following us here that this is, as I said, a recorded session, so we don't have the questions that are normally possible or the remarks during the podcast, but there will be the possibility to, and you will have the link there, to ask questions, to ask information. There will be information on the recorded session with some material. So I think we will prepare. Let's consider this to be a start of an increased role and support of the World Bank and everything they can do within our CE region, but also outside, because I'm sure many people are listening and watching us also outside. So I think let's make that agreement that we see how we can move forward, how we can start this. And then perhaps next year in June, when we will have our 8th or 9th conference, I think, East Meets West, we might see how we are already working and even then evaluate it and then push it forward in the right direction. I think that would be, thanks anyway. Thanks, Phil, for taking the time. I know you are now in Spain, so you want to go to the beach, probably. I understand that, of course. But anyway, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for sharing it with us, because it's really something new that this can become very big, and it's needed. It's really needed by many of our people. So yeah, thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you, Ludo. Thank you, Pavel. I'm really looking forward to this as you push the agenda, and just consider me always ready to push with you.
Perfect. Thank you very much, and see you next time. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Thanks. Bye.
Hello from backstage. It was cool, guys.
Was it cool? Of course. Oh, yeah. Cool. It's cool. Yeah. I think
you
it's
two are cool together for
but I think that, I mean, this is a thing you probably can have a conference for 5 days about it. In Antwerp now, in Brussels. Yeah, I'll be in Brussels.
Nice. Okay.
I left Vienna 2 years ago.
Oh, nice. Okay.
I'm in pension.
It's good to get out of Vienna.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you mean? I'm still here.
Oh, sorry. No offense.
And Antwerp is the gay capital of Belgium. Of Europe, they always say. It's not true, but it's a nice place to live.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I passed... Well, I was in the neighborhood. I didn't stop in Belgium, but I went from Denmark to Sweden, to Germany, France, Holland, France, and now in Spain.
So if you normally you don't stop in Belgium, because if you enter Belgium and you drive 120 kilometers an hour, before you know it, you're gone. You're very little, you know, we're very little. We are bigger than Monaco, and not as rich and not as beautiful, but it's also very small. You can just push your car and you're in Holland. Whoops, you're in Germany. Or Luxembourg. Easy.
Yeah.
I didn't have my makeup yet. You can see it.
I have my coffee.
I forgot my hair, my artificial hair. My fillers dropped down, so it's disaster. But I'm sure that Pavel can do some wonders with his magic stick, so that I still look like a nice guy. Okay, good. Okay. So, Mr. Schubert, can I start?